Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Philosopher's Forum. I'm David Alkeck, the president of this august body. And we have been...
We need louder. Where's your mic?
I need louder!
They use it over there.
Are you sure?
Yes. All right.
I'm David Alkeck, and the Philosopher's Forum has been going on for about 40 plus years, almost 45 years. Our emeritus member here who ran this show, Bob Berman, Dr. Robert Berman, is with us. And the Philosopher's Forum doesn't just talk about philosophy. Come on in. You're in the right place. But tonight, history, literature, science, all kinds of things. So, philosophy isn't free. We do have our expenses, so if you'll pay our treasurer $5 for your admission, unless you're a full-time student, which is $2, it's minimal. Let's see. Yes, make sure that you pay your food bill. We don't want to be just stuck with that. And take care of your server. Tell me, any new visitors tonight? Anybody that hasn't been here before? No? Good. Okay. So you know how the thing goes. Our speaker will speak for about 45 minutes or so, and then we'll have a Q&A. And when you ask a question, don't just go on and on and on, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes. Make it a question, okay, so that he can answer it for you. We are honored tonight to have Dr. Thomas Christian Williams. He goes by Chris, who was born and raised in Fort Worth. Got his BA from Texas Tech in political science, then an MBA from the University of Hartford, which also has a branch in Paris, which you attended also, is that right?
Exactly.
And he's lived most of his adult life in overseas, in France. He worked as an accountant, a commodities trader, a domestic affairs analyst of the U.S. Embassy in Paris. In Andorra, which is a very small little country in the Pyrenees. See, I know where it is. But between Spain and France. And he published his first novel. It's called, what, English Tomb? Napoleon Invades Louisiana in 2012?
Yep.
Okay. And so he writes historical fiction, too. So Chris is going to, he's currently working on his second novel, Kashu, White House. Okay, very good. You can tell us about that. He's going to tell us about Volney's Ruins, which is an interesting aspect of history that Thomas Jefferson was very interested in. And he has a couple of old books, one that was published in 1831 that is supposed to have been written, read by, and owned, I guess, partly for a time, by Abraham Lincoln. His fingerprints are still on.
I never said that.
I have schedules for the rest of the... The session here, the sessions, the spring, for y'all copies if you'd like them. The next one is March the 28th, Computational Models of Ethics by another Chris Davis. So without any further ado, Dr. Williams.
David, thank you for the kind introduction. Kenneth, thanks for all your help tonight. Thank you to everybody for allowing me to come speak to you here. You look around the world today, what do you see? War, migrations,
displaced people,
economic turmoil,
hunger,
religious strife,
radiation,
terrorism.
Hunger,
poverty,
disease, global populist revolt. Wouldn't it be nuts if there was a book that explains it all? A book of secular general principles that applies to all countries, all cultures, all continents. And yet, sure, why not? All centuries. A book the peoples of the world today could use to build peaceful, prosperous, transparent democracies. Wouldn't that be nice? Don't you think these folks right up there, they need a book like that? Does anybody know who and where they are?
Palmyra.
There you go, sir. Yes, exactly. Palmyra in modern-day Syria. ISIS obviously has one view of these ruins. Here's a slightly higher view. And here, of these exact same ruins, but from more than 200 years ago, is an even higher view. But that's not a terrorist you see seated there. That's a French philosopher by the name of Volney. V-O-L-N-E-Y. And the book he wrote, Ruins of Empires, provides solutions to those problems I spoke of, is indeed the book of secular general principles our species needs here in these tumultuous opening decades of the 21st century. Oh, that tastes good. Volney's Ruins was an instant success when it was first published in France, 1791. The book made Volney famous, from the Ganges in the east to the Mississippi in the west. Translated into English, the book was wildly popular in Belize here, United States, throughout the 19th century, really up until about World War I. The short list of Americans who read it, George Washington, Frederick Douglass, and indeed just about all of the abolitionists of that era, including a young Abraham Lincoln. Walt Whitman wrote his most famous poem, Leaves of Grass, based directly on Volney's ruins. What nobody knew during all that time, the most popular English language edition circulated in these here United States had been translated anonymously by Thomas Jefferson. That, by the way,
is the Jefferson statue in Paris. Take a look at it next time you're in town. It's right across from the Musée d'Orsay, and you can even see in the background there, that's the Louvre. So now you know where you are. Why did Jefferson translate Volney's ruins? He liked the book's simple theme. Empires rise if government allows enlightened self-interest to flourish. But Jefferson insisted on anonymity for his translation because he feared association with the book's controversial religious content would put at risk his chance of winning the presidency in the election of 1800. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But right here, my friends, you can glimpse the modern-day relevance of Volney's ruins. The central theme: empires rise if government allows enlightened self-interest to flourish, explains the rise of the United States and the collapse of the Soviet Union. As bonus, the book provides a solution to the world's enduring religious conflicts. Volney's Ruins isn't about yesterday. It's about today and tomorrow. And that is the reason Thomas Jefferson translated. Now then, before we get further into the book, let's take a close look at this Volney guy. Who was this cat, anyhow? You're looking right there at the world's best portrait of Volney. But you won't find it in France. Nope. It's in Philadelphia, at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. You can view it online. PAFA.org. And I'd like to thank them for allowing me to use it. Now, there's a lot I could say about Volney. We don't have, obviously, enough time here tonight to say everything. But he was a well-known guy in his era. Everybody knew him. And, just as importantly, he knew a lot of them. An example? Benjamin Franklin mentored a young Volney in the salons of Paris when he was a university student in the years before the French Revolution. In fact, it was Ambassador Franklin that introduced Volney to his successor, Thomas Jefferson. Volney was a member of the very first National Assembly. He took the tennis court oath. That's what you see here. He's one of the guys over on the upper left with the arms outstretched. He sat on the committee that wrote the very first French Constitution. Volney was jailed during the Terror, narrowly escaped the guillotine, and upon his release, he set sail for the United States. He was here. 1795-98. This was during the administration of John Adams. During his 3-year stay, Volney lived in the capital, Philadelphia. He visited a retired George Washington at Mount Vernon. He dined in New York City with John Jay and Alexander Hamilton. You folks will like this. He was inducted into the American Philosophical Society, still in existence in Philadelphia, by the then president of that august body. Who else? Thomas Jefferson. Starting to pick up a pattern here between Volney and Jefferson, yes? Toward the end of his 3-year stay, Volney was accused by President Adams of being a French spy. He was also accused of being an atheist in the Federalist Press. These two controversies garnered Volney a lot of unwanted attention. And in the end, he fled the U.S. just before the Alien Bill went into effect. Next time you're at Jefferson's residence, Volney was there too. You walk in the front door, I'm taking a little tour, there's a mantle, fireplace and a mantle, you'll see Volney's pyramid, a gift to Thomas Jefferson. Volney was France's number one Middle East expert. He spent 3 years living in the region there, and that was his first book. It was actually about Syria and Egypt before the ruins. But anyway, you can see this. I got this little model here from Monticello.org. Now, there's a lot I could tell you more about Volney, but the most important thing I want you to remember tonight is this. He gets back to France. He's inducted into the Institute. L'Académie Française. Seat number 24. You can look that up on the internet too. While he was there, he was a member of a school of philosophers / politicians known as the ideologues. These ideologues supported free press, free trade, the economic principles of Adam Smith, constitutional government, universal suffrage, abolition of slavery, and they were all correspondents of Thomas Jefferson. Well, these are all good things, no? These guys, these ideologues, they were on the right side of history on so many different major issues. Where does that pejorative attached to the word ideologue come from? From the throat, my friends, of Napoleon Bonaparte. You see, led by Volney, the ideologues supported the coup that brought Bonaparte to power. But then, when they figured out Bonaparte intended on reestablishing a hereditary monarchy with himself and his family, at the top of the pyramid, they became implacable opponents. It was then Bonaparte started to use the word ideologue as a pejorative. Whoa! C'est qu'est un ideologue? Qu'est-ce que mon père? A generation or so later, a certain German philosopher was reading into the history of the French Revolution, and he came upon this conflict between Bonaparte and the ideologues. And this certain German philosopher realized that the secular general principles supported by these ideologues represented an absolute refutation of the a theory. He was then trying to force upon Europe and indeed the entire planet. And so, this certain German philosopher picked up Bonaparte's pejorative and spread it around the world. Does anybody care to guess who was? Bonaparte. This was a gimme for you guys. It was a gimme. Karl Marx. But look at the word etymologically. Ideology, the science or the study of ideas. How do we conceive, test, accept, or reject ideas? That's the original meaning. That's the meaning the ideologues themselves understood. That's the meaning Bonaparte understood. That's the meaning Thomas Jefferson understood. The pejorative, you see, is a separate thing altogether. It has nothing to do with the original. So just remember, a partir de ce soir, et pour le reste de votre vie, you will remember, whenever you hear used that word in the pejorative sense, that comes from the throat of Napoleon Bonaparte as spread around the world by Karl Marx. This photograph is at the Institute, L'Académie Française. When I was a member of the political section at the embassy, we were privileged, very privileged, because they don't let just anybody in there. They call themselves immortals, after all. And so I had the whole political section going through. We had a professional guide and one of my contacts in the French establishment, let's say, was the president of the Sorbonne. And he was there too. He was a member of the Institute also, still is. And he was with us. And we were going through the Institute with this professional guide. She had never heard of Volney. He knew who Volney was. We were looking there. The place is just full with portraits and busts and statues of all the immortals over all the centuries. We were looking for Volney. I had the whole political section out there doing this, from the chief of the section all the way down through the interns. I mean, everybody was looking, all the corridors, all the rooms, all the grand salles and meeting rooms, everywhere. We couldn't find Volney. And toward the end, you know, after an hour of a professional tour, nobody could find this guy, and everybody was looking at me like, what's the matter with you, boy? End of the tour comes along, and I'm just totally finished. It's just like, I've been making all this big thing up, and I'm like totally failed in front of everybody very publicly. We go into the Court of Honor, and that is where the Volney stele is at the Institute. It's in the Court of Honor. It's the only stele in there. There's one other statue of some other guy from 150 years earlier. I don't remember his name, but there's only two statues, let's say, in the Court of Honor, and this is one of them. Obviously, this picture was taken some time ago. I've aged since then. I just turned 20.
Prematurely great.
Yes. So, now that we know a little bit about this cat, Volney, who he was, in reality, we're ready to take a deep dive into his book, Ruins of Empires. Volney's Ruins is a lost classic in Western literature. It's a review of human history from the perspective of a post-Enlightenment philosopher. It's a book of wisdoms. It's not a book of prophecies like Nostradamus. It is a book of secular general principles. Exact circumstances never repeat. But general principles do. Volney's Ruins is divided into two sections, a political science section and a General Assembly of Nations section. In the political science section, Volney defines the general principle that determines the destiny of an empire. The book opens here with this lone philosopher traveling through Syria. Arriving at the ruins of Palmyra, the philosopher stands on a cliff overlooking the ruins of this once great city. And he says to himself, here, in the middle of this barren desert, once flourished a thriving metropolis, a vibrant marketplace. What lessons can be learned from these ruins? Is there a general principle that describes the rise and fall of empires? At this moment, a genie appears. The genie represents the voice of reason,
With the genie's help, the philosopher derives this formula. Empires rise, if government allows. Enlightened self-interest to flourish. Volney defines enlightened self-interest as self-interest. That's the thing you're born with. That's the survival instinct that everybody has. And that all governments must pay attention to. But while it can be used for good, it can also become, it can be used for bad. It can become that dog-eat-dog thing when everybody is out looking for their own self-interests, right? To prevent that, Volney adds three attributes. The first one, education. So we don't repeat the mistakes of the past and the present. The second one, moderation. Moderation of your passions. You don't go around all your life eating fast food, drinking sugar drinks, for example, or driving crazily jacked up high pickup trucks down the freeway at 90 miles an hour. That's moderation. And finally, the golden rule. Treat others as you want to be treated. This four-part definition is Volney's enlightened self-interest. He goes deeper into the subject in his 1793 book, Law of Nature, and there he describes a universal system of morality based on the physical laws of nature. You will often find Volney's Ruins and Law of Nature bound together in a single volume. And both books must be read to fully understand his principles. Volney wrote Ruins of Empires as a refutation of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's social contract. If you refute Rousseau, you refute the moral foundation of socialism. Perhaps you've been wondering why Volney isn't better known in France. Well, here you have the reason. The moral foundation of the modern-day French social model is Rousseau's social contract, and it was refuted by a Frenchman, a hero of the French Revolution, no less, more than two centuries ago. Now then, I'd like to read a couple of excerpts from the political science section, which will give you a flavor of the book. Both excerpts also have a certain resonance to events happening right here and now in the modern day. The first excerpt is from chapter 11, The Cause of the Decline of the Ancient States. In this chapter, Volney describes the general principles which lead to a nation's decline and eventual collapse. But what I want to focus on is Volney's description of the rise of a certain kind of leader. A leader he calls the ambitious man. I'll read just a few lines and see if they sound familiar, like he's describing someone you know today. Observing the spirit of egoism, which incessantly divides mankind, the ambitious man encouraged it with dexterity, flattered the vanity of one, excited the jealousy of another, favored the avarice of this, inflamed the resentment of that, and irritated the passions of all. Then, placing in opposition their interests and prejudices, he sowed divisions and hatreds, promised to the poor the spoils of the rich, to the rich the subjugation of the poor, threatened one man by another, this class by that, and filling everyone with distrust, created his strength by their weakness. Any ideas? Okay. Again, exact circumstances never repeat, but general principles do. Here's the second excerpt from the political science section. It's from chapter 12, Lessons of the Past, repeated in the present. This was written more than 200 years ago, 1791. In this chapter, Volney and the genie fly high above the earth. They look down on Asia Minor, on the shores of the Black Sea, on a region known as the Crimea. The Crimea is kind of in the news these days, isn't it? You've heard that word recently, right, in the news broadcast? There, Volney and the genie see two armies at war, each praying to God for victory. One, the army of the Tsar of Moscow. And who would that be today? The other, the Tartars, a band of Islamist pirates. In the 21st century today, we call this conflict Chechnya. Observing the never-ending war between these two God-fearing enemies, Volney traces the roots of this conflict to obscure fundamentalist forces on both sides, namely the Russian Orthodox Church and Islamist imams. And he writes the following lines. Deluded mortals, is it thus you revere the divinity? Hath God the heart of a mortal, with passions ever changing? Is he, like you, motivated by vengeance or compassion, wrath or vengeance? According to you, it seems God is whimsical and capricious, angered or appeased as a man, that he loves and hates alternately, that he broods over his hatred. He punishes the evils he permits. He foresees but does not stop crimes. Like a corrupt judge, he is bribed with offerings. Like an ignorant despot, he makes laws and revokes them. Like a savage tyrant, he grants or resumes favor without reason. And he can only be appeased by servility. Ah, now I know the lying spirit of man. Contemplating the picture of the divinity they have drawn, it is easy to see God did not create man in his own image, but the reverse. Man created God in his own image. Now let's just stop right there and consider a few things. First, had it been known, Thomas Jefferson translated those exact lines, he would never have been elected President of the United States. Second, note how Volney identifies the source of this eternal conflict, priests and imams on both sides, who encourage their respective flocks to go to war rather than admit their religion might be in part responsible for that conflict. Third, looking beyond the Crimea to the entire world, Volney has described in an analogous fashion the situation humanity faces today. Follett has identified obscure fundamentalist forces directing much of the conflict currently engulfing our planet in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, with spillover effects being felt worldwide, including in Europe and the United States. And I don't mean just terrorism occurring here in the homeland. I mean obscure fundamentalist forces bubbling up today in the West, winning elections, changing constitutions, limiting freedoms, foisting their religious agendas on others. In this country, fundamentalist churches play an important role in the election of the current president and in the election of the majorities in both houses of Congress. Look at the cabinet picks of the president. Many of them have fundamentalist religious links or backgrounds. But the United States isn't alone in this. Across Europe, East and West, many of the so-called nationalist governments, now in power or soon to be elected, have links, direct or indirect, to fundamentalist churches or denominations. In Europe, this usually means the far-right branches of the Catholic Church or the Orthodox churches of Russia, the Balkans, and Greece. Now, I know Volney pretty well. I've written an entire historical fiction novel featuring him. So I believe I can say, with some measure of authority, if Volney were alive today, he would not be surprised by the situation faced by humanity. He would say, humanity is ignoring the lessons contained in his ruins, ignoring those lessons at its own peril. Volney would say the true battle going on today is not left versus right, Muslim versus Christian, or Muslim versus Jew, or Sunni versus Shia. No. The situation humanity faces today, in all countries, all cultures across this planet, moderns versus fundamentalists. That being the case, looking ahead into the future, what do I see coming? Holy war. Obscure fundamentalist forces have wanted it a long time. Now they've got control of some of the most important nations on the planet. Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Israel, India, Poland, Hungary, Russia, and yes, the United States. Maybe tomorrow we're going to find out Holland, later this spring, our sister republic, France. It will take only one spark to ignite a vast conflagration. Holy war. That's what Volney would tell us. That's what he would see in our horoscope. So there you have it, my friends. That's my analysis of the current situation faced by humanity according to the general principles of Volney in Chapter 12, Lessons of the Past, repeated in the present. Now then, let's move on to the second section of Volney's Ruins, the General Assembly of Nations. Now we're coming to the reason Jefferson insisted on anonymity for his translation. There are numerous controversial statements made throughout the book. You've already heard some of them. But the real theological fireworks begin in the General Assembly of Nations section. It's kind of a fictional first meeting of the United Nations. Here, Volney traces the history of world religions. The nations of the world then get into an argument with each claiming to represent the true word of God. There's a big debate. Nothing is settled. Everyone camps on their positions. Does this sound something like what's going on right now? Into this situation, a lone philosopher comes on stage and presents a solution to the world's enduring religious conflicts. The solution comes in three parts. First, we must recognize the difference between a physical truth and a metaphysical assertion. Physical truths are easily demonstrated in the physical world. The sun is round. It's not square. It's not triangular. Water flows downhill, not uphill. Each of us, using our own five senses, can verify these physical truths. But what about these statements? Moses spoke with a burning bush. Jesus rose on the third day. Martyrs for the prophet get X number of virgins in paradise. These are metaphysical assertions that have no physical evidence to support them. You just have to have faith. They are correct. All religions found their moral systems on these types of assertions. Problems begin when one religion tries to impose its metaphysical assertions on another religion. This is the source of the world's enduring religious conflicts. Now comes the second part of Volney's solution. Shock therapy. Let's say God is coming to our planet tomorrow. When God appears, he, she, it, they, whatever, will select only one religion out of all the religions as the perfect system of morality. These few true believers will become the chosen people. Everybody else of all the other religions? Heretics, infidels, non-believers, they will be killed. But that's not enough. Because when God comes tomorrow, he, she, it, they, whatever, will select only one denomination within that one religion. All the others? But even that is not enough. Because when God comes tomorrow, he, she, it, they, whatever, will choose only those who practice without fault the principles of that one denomination within that one religion. Everybody else? It is clear, my friends, this insistence of all fundamentalists to make others accept their metaphysical assertions leads to only one result. Holy war. Eternal conflict. And perhaps, in the nuclear age, the death of humanity. Are we not witnessing this exact situation right here and now, today? Now comes the third part. As a replacement for metaphysics, Volney says we must recognize a universal system of morality based in the physical world, not up in the clouds somewhere on some invisible being no one has ever met, and everybody argues about what they really mean, that he, she, it, they, whatever, thus creating a physical truth that we can all agree on. Here is the basis of that system. All humans are born with a desire to survive. This is a universal physical world truth we can all agree on. We are unanimous on this point. Just like we are unanimous, the sun is round and water flows downhill. I want to live, you want to live. It's something we feel in our physical bodies. The individual's desire to survive is nothing but self-interest, the foundation stone of Volney's enlightened self-interest. Volney concludes his ruins with these lines: to live in harmony and peace, we must trace a line of distinction between subjects that are capable of verification and those that are not. We must separate by an inviolable barrier the world of fantastical beings from the world of realities. This is Volney's call for separation of church and state. If Volney were alive today, he would look around at the problems facing our species, and he would make two recommendations for every nation to follow. Less social contract. More secular government. So now you understand why Thomas Jefferson wanted to translate Volney's ruins. He liked the book's central theme: empires rise if government allows enlightened self-interest to flourish. But he insisted on anonymity for his translation because he feared the book's controversial religious content would put at risk his chance of winning the election in 1800. Where is the proof Jefferson actually translated Volney's ruins? Letters between Volney and Jefferson were published by the French researcher Gilbert Chinat in 1923, published in the Johns Hopkins Press. Nobody paid attention. Those same letters can now be found online today at founders.archives.gov. And now, here's where I come in. There's a manuscript in Jefferson's hands. It's in the Coolidge Collection, Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston, the oldest historical society in the U.S., founded in 1791, the same year Ruins was published. They didn't even know what they had. I found it online. Told them. Well, by the way, guys, they invited me to come speak up there. About 5 people signed up. No, another time, guys. You'll see that on the internet if you search my name, Thomas Christian Williams. You'll see that. I was going to speak. Anyway, Massachusetts Historical Society has the manuscript up there. And just this past fall, I was in D.C. I went to the Library of Congress. They've got a fragment, chapter 13, Jefferson's manuscript. They didn't know what it was. Let me tell you what this is. They had it misclassified. Something else. Totally off base. I said, no, this is part of Volney's Ruins. Oh! Now they've got it correctly classified. So there is your physical evidence proof. Why does no one seem to know about Jefferson's translation? There are many reasons. One is, Jefferson only translated the Invocation plus the first 20 chapters of the 24-chapter book. Another American in Paris, Joel Barlow, finished the last 4 chapters. Barlow's name then became associated with the entire translation. All these years, it was a nice way of hiding surreptitiously Jefferson's involvement. But for me, the most important reason no one seems to know about the Jefferson translation is this. Volney's Ruins transcends the left-right political debate. The left doesn't like Volney because he promotes enlightened self-interest, not Rousseau's social contract. The right doesn't like Volney because he establishes a system of morality based here in the physical world without reference to a god or gods. Result? Volney has no champions, with one possible exception. One thing is certain. Jefferson's translation of this book represents an endorsement of Volney's Enlightenment-based worldview. It's an endorsement we, of these tumultuous opening decades of the 21st century, would do well to pay attention to. In this era of global populist revolt, Ruins of Empires is a gift from Volney through Jefferson. It's not about yesterday, it's about today and tomorrow. And that is the reason Thomas Jefferson translated it. Irony of ironies. A century ago, 2 centuries ago, everyone read Volney's Ruins and nobody knew Thomas Jefferson translated it. Today, we know Jefferson translated it, but nobody is reading Volney's Ruins. What does that say about those folks back then, and what does that say about us today? If we are ever going to move beyond left-right politics, this book is a good place to start. As conclusion, I would like to read the opening lines of the Invocation to Volney's Ruins as translated by Thomas Jefferson. We're all right here, right? Put yourself there on that colline, that cliffside overlooking the ruins of Palmyra. There we are. Hail, solitary ruins. Holy sepulchres, silent walls. You, I invoke. To you, I address my prayer. While your aspect averts with secret terror the vulgar regard, it excites in my heart the charm of delicious sentiments, sublime contemplations. What useful lessons, what affecting and profound reflections you suggest to those who know how to consult you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. Now we're going to have a Q&A.
Hello?
So, any questions from the class?
Bring it on.
I'm sure I just haven't read enough of Rousseau. Could you distinguish for me how the social contract is in contradiction with liberal democracy government?
Are you talking liberal in the U.S. sense of that word, or in the European sense of that word?
Liberal in the traditional sense, free.
Okay, well, that's the European sense.
I understand. That's what I'm looking for.
So, okay, so you're looking for the difference between the European version of liberal democracy and Volney's ruins.
Yes.
Same thing.
Social
contract. Okay, yes. Now, okay, yes. That's different. That's the different animal. Yes. No, it's liberal in the European sense of the word. It's what we would call conservative economics and small government. They used to call it, before the Republicans, they were called the Whigs. And there was a Whig party in England. And that was the small government party. And that is the kind of liberal democracy that the Europeans all see as a theory. But of course, it's not really being practiced anywhere because the social contract has pretty much taken over all of Europe.
That was Jeffersonian's idea of democracy also.
Yes.
Small government.
That's why he and Volney got along so well.
Recognizing that Volney would have reacted more to Rousseau because they were both Frenchmen, the social contract theory is also in Hobbes and Locke, and that would have been as equally familiar to the founders. And so when you contrast enlightened self-interest with social contract, a Lockean social contract, to my understanding, would be a big influence on the founders, including Jefferson. I mean, so I appreciate your...
Yes, well, absolutely. And one of Volney's big heroes was John Locke. Absolutely. He was following the whole thing about law of nature. Volney's law of nature follows very much so, and gets more into politics than did John Locke. But John Locke was famous for writing about law of nature, natural law.
This is really a follow-up question on the last two. So are you saying that Volney had a problem with social contract theory or with Rousseau's social contract theory?
Rousseau's social contract.
Not necessarily sure. The social contract.
Yes, I mean, broadly speaking, any kind of government or even something as small as a family is, in fact, a social contract of a certain kind, right? But no, he was a major opponent of... Back in the day, when Volney was growing up, the big debate wasn't left-right, it was Voltaire versus Rousseau. Yeah. Volney fell very much into the Voltairian camp. As a matter of fact, as long as I'm on that, it's a made-up name. He made that up, Volney. His real name was Chassebeuf, Beef Chaser. Okay? Which is a good reason why you would want to change your name. Anyway, so he took Voltaire's first three letters and the last three letters from the town in France on the Swiss border where Voltaire lived, called Ferne, F-E-R-N-E-Y, and thus you have Volne. By the way, as long as we're on this point about the names, I've been in contact with Volne. There are people named Volne in the U.S. There's a lot of them. And it's got two sources. One is there's a Germanic source, and it means of the people, which it totally fits with Volne anyway, that particular source, but it has nothing to do with him. He just made up that word. And then there are other people, other families in the U.S. who have named generations of children. Volne is in there either as a first, middle, or last name. They carried that name forward, and it was because of the influence of Volney's ruins throughout that 19th century period. I gave a speech to the Louisiana Historical Society in New Orleans many years ago on Volney's influence on the Louisiana Purchase, which I did not get into. Like I said, there was a lot of stuff I wasn't going to talk about tonight. When I did that, one of the officers of the Louisiana Historical Society was a professional archivist. She did some research, and she told me that Volney's Ruins was the third most common book in the Creole library back in the day. The first two, the Bible and the Social Contract.
I think, if I'm right, the reason he was against the Social Contract, or Rousseau's Social Contract, was if you extrapolate Rousseau's theory that, you know, in order for us to come together in a society, we give up some of our freedoms to the government, that was extrapolated to a dictatorship. You know,
yes.
Robespierre loved that. He loved that. His committee.
Ding, ding, ding. I might add and just kind of leapfrog off that. Volney says, you know, he's okay with understanding that we're going to have to give away when you come into society, be it two persons as a family or something larger, the size of a country, you're going to have some of your freedoms regulated, let's say. But you should be more powerful afterward. It's easier for two people to defend the plot of land than it is one person to defend that top plot of land. Three people, it's even easier. So by bringing more and more people together, you should actually be more powerful as being a member of that group. And one of the reasons why empires survive if they allow enlightened self-interest to flourish is this. When the empire, the country, the culture comes under threat, be it internal or external, the more people who have been participating in that country, in that culture, in that contract, they will defend the system that has defended their rights. And the reason why empires, countries collapse is because fewer and fewer people are interested in seeing that system continue. There's only a very narrow range of high-ranking communists who wanted the Soviet Union to survive in 89, and it collapsed. Because such few numbers wanted it, had a stake in its continued existence. Everybody else was excluded. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think the United States in the modern political context, I think Biden's a libertarian, or maybe even a sort of libertarian in terms of the Republican Party, would certainly agree with Volney's ideas. My question to you, however, is the following. Why does Volney want to say something more moderate, like, if a country adopts his ideas, that country as a republic will be a very successful country, to instead talk about that they'll have empires as if that'll be a good thing? Because it seems to me in every real case, when you look at what happened with an empire, it started out bad and got worse, where you end up, basically the whole thing was propped up with sort of government subsidies, it was a bunch of protectionist types of, you know, British East India Company. far from free trade, that kind of thing, and that you eventually end up with pretty much a disaster that's so arduous that the taxes are such pain that the British themselves, the French themselves, all want to get rid of their empires. And, you know, sort of arguably, it's the backdraft from those empires that's caused some of the populace to roll less on religious grounds.
Great question.
Tax.
I get the gist.
Yeah.
I get the gist. Okay. Great question. I'm glad you asked that. The simple way to get around that is just as I was doing, speaking on the prior question, expand the definition of the word empire. Allow it to be instead, just put there instead, country. Just put there instead, culture. Just put there instead, a people. Okay? Vollet was thinking and writing and living in a pre-Marxian era. What you're bringing up is post-Marxian imperialist and anti-imperialist doctrine. All right? So, everything you said is absolutely correct. I think what Volney would say is that I'm not talking about empires like the British Empire with its mercantilistic system and all that kind of thing going on. Look at it more broadly. Give it a more general definition. Just insert the word country there. Insert the word culture there. Insert the word people there.
With regard to Volney's reading of history, with regard to which empires he considered to have flourished, my impression would be that the Roman Empire from about Julius Caesar forward, about 500 years, flourished. You know, true, it fell. It flourished about 500 years before it fell, but I don't think there was a lot of mighty self-interest after the Republic fell. So, I mean, how did he read all those, the Persians, the Romans, the Chinese Han? I mean, is he saying that they fell and therefore they didn't really flourish, and the one that has a lot of self-interest will never fall? Is that what he's saying?
I think, yes, he would agree with your last sentence there. What he would say is, and what he describes in Ruins of Empires is when a nation, a country, a culture gets going, they have a tendency to be very open to their citizenry and allowing everyone to participate, right? And so there's this coming up period, this strengthening period, almost like being a young adult. And then they get a little bit, reach middle age there, and they get a little bit satiated, they get a little bit overweight, they get a little bit tired, they get a little bit proud. And so that can lead to the downfall unless you're regenerating in those moments.
I have two questions that for you for the present that you posed. First is religious war, holy war, inevitable, as you say, and will there ever be an end to conservative versus liberal, right versus left? It seems to be...
It's so ingrained, that's true. Is holy war inevitable? No, absolutely not. But I do believe we're approaching. As I see the world, and I'm not alone in this. I mean, this is no unique insight on my part. I'm just looking at what's going on now through the Volnean lens to interpret what's going on. But I think a lot of people see the same thing coming, and some people are actively trying to get it done.
Yeah, I've got a question and sort of clarification of your outline, the way it ended up with the elimination or replacement of metaphysical with the physical. Can you hear me now?
Sorry.
With the replacement, that's the last point of the solution for the patients, whatever. If that's the case, I'm sure you all are familiar with the Jeffersonian Bible, where he redacts or removes all the miracles.
Good point.
And it's been redone completely by the Smithsonian. There's a two-hour special on it.
Right.
I was fascinated by that, but it seemed to reflect the nature of replacing the miracles, the metaphysical with the physical, that is, with the consistent with his translation of this document, the ruins. Does that make sense?
Sure. I would hesitate to use, and I do not believe I use the word replacement.
Yeah, you do. I wrote it down.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, let me say this. Everybody keeps their religion. It's not that religions are going to be somehow outlawed. That would be a crazy thing to attempt in the first place. But Bonnet is saying, as our point of commonality, we must adopt. We must find this physical world truth to found that new morality that we can all agree on, because we're not going to agree on the metaphysical things.
Well,
because
well, there's... Well, if you take the lessons of the Bible, and those are the reality, those are the things he teaches, the miracles are eliminated in this Bible. By the way, it's a very sharp instrument. Very precise,
yeah.
Cut out and reassembled by the Smithsonian. Or did reassemble it, but they redid it and bound it together. It seems to me that it tells something about his nature when you look at both books. The Bible, the way he treated that, and the way he treats the rules.
I fully see your point, and I say it's interesting that Jefferson was still going down this same route. Did he do that after he was president?
I don't know.
Because he did the Ruins translation when he was vice president.
Okay.
And so he was looking toward the future, trying to give Americans a book of morality that they could use. Yes. You know, to maintain the strength of the nation. And as I mentioned to Ken, to reinforce the Enlightenment-based principles upon which the United States was founded.
Thank you very much.
We have time for one more question because they want us to get out here by 9 o'clock. So is there a last question by anybody?
How would you shape the United States?
Just a minute.
Like the objectivist, an Anne Rand, the Darwinistic approach to enlightened self-interest versus the libertarian idea of enlightened self-interest without any relationship to the metaphysical.
I've called Anne Rand Institute, and I've read Anne Rand quite a lot, and I like her stuff, okay? What I see is missing, though, in her stuff is the piece, the four part of enlightened self-interest, self-interest, naked self-interest that can become dog-eat-dog, and then education, moderation, and the golden rule. What Ayn Rand seems to miss, I think, is that golden rule part. But I was going to say, I've called Ayn Rand, the Institute, there, not her, but the Institute didn't count on. And I don't believe in metempsychosis. And I said, is there any Volney in her library? I just wanted to know if maybe she somewhere had come across Volney. And they said no.
So, thank you.